Well, hello everyone and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week, a change in our usual format. I'm the person being interviewed. Last summer, I wrote a small book about us, the Australian media, and looking at the impact of technological disruption, both on our industry, on society at large, and on politics. The little book is now in shops, and the conversation you're about to hear is from an event I did very recently at the ANU in Canberra. Michelle Grattan, the political editor of The Conversation, is putting me through my paces in this conversation, and we are talking about On Disruption, which is published by Melbourne University Press.
A great pleasure to have Catherine and Michelle here with us to talk about Catherine's latest book On Disruption. I've been watching people as they've come in, and it's fascinating now how we are all so attached to our devices. The world is incredibly different to the world I think most of us at least grew up in, and the boundaries between public and private have almost completely dissolved. We live in what we are told is a 24-hour media news cycle, and for those of us who have younger relatives, we know that their adoption of social media leaves us all in their wake. So what are we to make of this? What might we to make of this? Is this the new normal? What's happening? How can we understand it? If you don't have a copy of Catherine's book yet, then Dimmocks will be selling more books after the event in the foyer, so don't miss out. And we will also have time for Q&A this evening, so please be ready with your questions, and we have some roving mics that will come to you. So, both of our guests need very little introduction, but it would be remiss of me not to do so. Catherine Murphy is the political editor of Guardian Australia and has worked in Canberra's Parliamentary Gallery for 21 years. She's an adjunct professor of journalism at the University of Canberra and a director of the National Press Club. In 2008, Catherine won the Paul Lynham Award for Excellence in Press Gallery Journalism and has been a Walkley finalist twice. And facilitating the conversation with Catherine tonight is Michelle Grattan, who is herself a former editor of the Canberra Times and the first female editor of an Australian metropolitan daily newspaper. She's held a number of positions, including the Australian Financial Review, the Sydney Morning Herald, and she was the political editor at The Age. She's currently chief political correspondent at The Conversation and a professorial fellow also at the University of Canberra. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Catherine Murphy and Michelle Grattan.
Well, it's great to be here with you tonight with Catherine to celebrate and take apart the book that she's produced, a very timely book when there's so much debate about the media and about the disrupted political system as well. So let me start with the story of the week, and I don't know whether I should ask you what that is, but it's probably not the distribution of the GST. The David Leinhelm story and his exchanges with Sarah Hanson-Young. And Catherine, I wonder whether you think that this very unedifying incident, a continuing incident, fits into this phenomenon of disruption.
It's absolutely a perfect case study. Actually, this story at a number of levels. We couldn't have asked for a better story this week, actually, to illustrate the central thesis in the book. But before we kick off, I just want to say thank you to Michelle for being part of this with me. People may not be aware that Michelle and I have worked together for a very long period of time, and this woman sitting next to me is my most important journalistic mentor, so I'm just overwhelmed that she's agreed to do this for me, and it'll be a tough interview because they always are. So, back to David Leinhelm and why this represents a perfect case study of what I'm trying to talk about. With this story, we're covering a real thing that happened. We're also covering a genuine cultural moment where women as a group, certainly me, myself, my friends, I think professional women generally, have had a gutful and have determined really in the wake of Me Too to not take any crap anymore. So that's also a real thing and something that we need to cover. But what we're also covering is a classic example of the echo chamber. Because what happened basically was that David Leonhard used the opportunity of this outrage to speak to his own supporters. It was a narrow casting exercise. That's why he didn't apologise. I hate to say it to this room, but I have no doubt whatsoever that there are votes in his unrepentant stance. And so as a journalist, this is very difficult territory in the modern news cycle, because there's a thing to cover, a real thing, an important thing that you want to give due respect to. There's also the opportunities, ample opportunities, to be manipulated in terms of the coverage. So this is difficult. there's no easy answers to it. And what we've seen with this story is the classic case of the amplification of a conflict, right? We've just had this rolling stoush all week. No one's any wiser as a result of it, and there's no resolution to it, which again is sort of a classic example of these echo chamber stories that are happening in the modern news cycle. And that presents enormous challenges for us as journalists. What do? We ignore it? Set ourselves up as censors? I don't think so. And if we start setting ourselves up as censors, that's the time you've got to worry about us, when we determine what needs to be reported and not reported on some arbitrary judgment that we exercise. So we can't ignore it. Do we report it? Obviously we do. But we need to report it with a degree of self-awareness. We need to understand that because of technological change, the system can deliver perverse results. So my end point is report it with self-awareness. But anyway, we'll unpack this a bit more in this conversation, but it's just a classic example of what we're talking about when we talk about the disrupted media cycle.
Can we move to the contrast between what was the old system in our time and the new system through just looking at your own experience? You talk in the book about arriving at the Financial Review as a former public servant, so with some knowledge of Canberra, some contacts and so on, and life there, and we were actually at the Fin at the same time, and then your much faster-paced life currently. Mm. Can you just take us through that contrast and how you coped with the disruption to your journalistic way of working?
Yes, well, how we both did, really. Let's be honest. It was kind of fun in a way, mentally going back to 1996, because it's sort of like imagining life as a print journalist in 1996 and trying to compare that with life now. It was almost like an hallucination. It was kind of like, how could we have actually lived in an era where I, as a journalist, communicated with my readers once every 24 hours? It's kind of like, whoa, that actually happened. Yeah, it did, and not that long ago. So that was kind of fun to recreate those conditions in my head. And I sort of did it, perhaps just at a temporal level, maybe just comparing two election nights might help Michelle in terms of illustrating this. Like 1996, I was out at the National Tally Room. Remember that, guys? Remember that?
Yep.
How we used to have election results up on a big scoreboard? So I was out there, I was working for the Fin Review. We didn't have a paper on the Sunday, so I was able to wander around, talk to people, gather intel, experience the really amazing thing that one experiences as a journalist in Canberra, and that's a change of government. It feels like a revolution has occurred of some type. So I went around, sucked up the atmosphere, talked to a bunch of people, thought about things, wrote a few notes, interviewed a few people, went back into my office on Sunday, thought some more, God forbid, thought a bit more, rolled things around in my head. Then we basically produced the election results for Sunday for Monday for the paper. So that was 1996. The last federal election, at that point I was the live blogger for Guardian Australia. And if you guys haven't seen a live blog before, it's basically a rolling account of the news as it happens. So literally you file all day every 10 minutes. So I did the live shift on election night. When I finished my life shift, we regrouped, and that was, it was a close election, so I don't think the blog knocked off until after midnight. We regrouped. I wrote a story for the morning because I wanted to capture that really magnificent moment when Malcolm Turnbull just lost it in front of the Australian people, right? Where he just absolutely lost it. It was just so fantastic, it had to be recorded. So I wrote a piece, a sketchy type piece, you know, I don't know, somewhere between 1 and 2 a.m., I think, wrote that. Then my colleagues, Lenore Taylor and Gabby Chan, and I repaired off into a small studio and we recorded a podcast, an election night podcast, which remains our favourite podcast of all time. It's called the 3 a.m. podcast, where we just raved, basically, about election night and the traumatic experience we'd had of an eight-week winter election campaign. And then we came out and we had a bit more of a think and we thought, okay, we've got a new story nosed for the morning. So then we sort of dealt with that and I think we staggered home about 5 a.m. Then we turned around, came back into the office and, in fact, the next day I was taking over from Lenore as political editor. So I ended my live stint and ended up in the political editor's job. And then we had to face a whole new day. Now, the point of this, I stress, is not to me to sit up and say, woe is me, I work hard. Everybody in this room works hard. Everybody in the Australian economy works hard. Everybody in the Australian economy is living some example of the disruption that I talk about in this book. Everybody is. I don't think we're special. I don't think that somehow, you know, statues need to be erected to our fortitude. The point of having this conversation is that our disruption is consequential for what happens in society and the way people assess information, but we're going to go there, so I won't steal the thunder.
Well,
did I answer the question?
I'm sure. Just before we do go there, though, I'm always fascinated by this question of whether when there's so much more media activity in quantity and so much more political activity in quantity, I mean, these characters are out every day, all day, where we used to be begging for press conferences and now we're often just wishing maybe have a holiday today, Bill, or Malcolm, just, you know, go and be on the harbour or something. Anyway, there is so much more, but are we really closer to things? Because sometimes I feel that we've got a bit of a wall around us, even though that we've got all this quantity. What do you feel, contrasting your early journalistic experience and getting close to ministers and so on, with currently?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's weird because in some respects in the digital era and in the big Parliament House era and all of that, in some ways we're more connected than we used to be in a weird way because we're sort of connected across digital platforms as well as in the real world. You know, we watch what they do digitally, they watch what we do, they respond, you know, it's sort of, we have that, in some ways we're more connected but more distant, strangely. In my print form, in that first 10 years of my career, you know, for instance, this was sort of pre-news channels, right? So we did a lot more sit-down long-form interviews in the print era. You know, you sort of barged your way. Michelle actually taught me this trick that if the minister wasn't, or the minister's advisor wasn't returning your calls or whatever, you just go and sit in their foyer until they talk to you. So that was a good trick. That served me well on many an occasion. We used to do that. We used to go, and I'm not saying we don't do that now, but we don't do as much of it because what these guys do in order to shovel content through every available channel real fast is they use the news channels as their visual press releases these days. So a conga line of them will go on Sky News or on ABC 24 or whatever and blah, 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 off it goes. And there's less actual sit-down, long-form interviews.
Mind you, you can camp outside Sky News on...
Well, obviously, Robert.
On certain really needy occasions.
Well, of course, we've been there. We've absolutely been there. So, yeah, the relationship's different. The relationship is different. It's a bit hard to put your finger on how and why, but it is different.
Yes, I think that's certainly the case. Now, coming back to your broad thesis, can you just outline that for people, the whole theory of disruption or the observation of disruption.
Yeah. Well, it's like I was saying a minute ago, again, and I feel like I do need to stress this, that it's, I don't think we're unique, I don't think we're special, I don't think anyone needs to have a pity party for us. I really don't. But why I want to examine our disruption and why I think there's a public interest in it is that everybody inhabits our ecosystem some way or other. Everyone is connected to it in some shape or form. People consume what we do, they watch what politicians say. We're all connected, basically, in that universe. And our disruption, as a consequence, is society's disruption. Now, I'm not, you know, it's obvious to people, I reckon, right? It's obvious to people sitting in this room, okay, Uber has disrupted the taxi industry, or Airbnb has sort of revolutionised what someone's idea of a hotel is, right? But what's happened in the media is, I think, a bit harder to put together if you're not standing at the coalface of it. You can sort of see that everything's faster, sharper, more conflict-addled, but it may not really be clear why and what the consequences of that are. And in no particular... I mean, I think you should care about this, really, in no particular order, because it sort of... it impacts what you're consuming in a number of ways. It basically, you know, disruption has basically busted apart the business models for commercial media companies, and that puts a question mark about whether or not journalism will be viable in the future. That's a real issue. It's a real pressing concern. Because of the way information is distributed, you know, because now the big social media giants are publishers themselves, all this content is washing around the system. It's harder and harder for people to work out what's real and what's fake. And then people start to question all the information that they consume. Is this fair dinkum? Is it fake? Does it have an agenda? Is it, you know, written by some person in a Moldavian basement? I mean, it becomes very difficult for people to understand and trust information, and that is a big deal in our society, that sort of breakdown of trust. What else? I think, as well as that trust point, there's the bigger cultural phenomenon that's sitting behind this disruption, and that's the kind of unmooring that's happening in society as a consequence of digital and the impact of digital. We've been picked up and moved away and put down in a different place. And basically, now that the news cycle flows all the time, the conflict cycle gets kind of more and more compressed, it becomes noisier and noisier. There's a lot of kind of push in technology to push people into tribes. Social media algorithms show people what they will agree with, not what they don't agree with. So there's this constant narrowing that's going on. People are being pushed into sort of little tribal enclaves. And that, for me, is really disturbing at a number of levels. And I think the reason to sort of hang a lantern over this and say all of these things connect to each other is to try and get people to think about that. And I've had a conversation about being a self-aware journalist. It's also self-aware media consumer. Understand what's happening and why, so that you get some way of navigating the complexity of the current environment.
Do you think we're getting more junk journalism these days? Lots of fat, not much nutrition.
you guys will tell us that, I think, at the end of the night. But yes, I think we are. I do think we're getting better. I think sort of when the big disruption hit, which was when the internet arrived, I think there was a period where we all just sort of had to reinvent what we were doing in front of you all. And we had no idea what we were doing. Had absolutely no idea what we were doing. And we just had to adapt in front of you and get on with it. And I think in that early disruption, there was a lot of junk. There was a lot of junk. I think news organisations are deliberately trying to pull that back a bit and try and sort of not make the new supplant the important, but it is quite difficult. So I think the straight answer to the question is yes.
So when you started your blog, audience engagement was obviously very important.
Yep.
And to you in particular, you were saying to your audience, let's interact.
Yep.
What do you feel now, some years later, about that sort of engagement? Because audiences for live blogs and audiences for media in general, where you get an instant feedback, a part of that audience is quite nasty and aggressive and difficult to handle. Have you found that you've pulled back at all from that engagement?
Have I pulled back? No, I don't think I've pulled back. I'm less of an enthusiast. You guys need to know that Michelle used to look at me like I was completely insane when I would sort of wander around the office saying, isn't this fantastic, you know, isn't this brilliant? I can talk to readers all the time. Michelle would kind of look at me like, okay, this will run its course. I'm certainly about digital generally less of an optimist than I was at the start. There's no doubt about that. I'm certainly more worried than I was when this bus hit us, basically, and I was kind of, I don't know, in some sort of hyperventilating state. But no, I don't think I've pulled back. I think actually one of the real upsides about the digital environment is the redrawing of the relationship between the journalist and the audience. I think that's good. I think pre-digital journalists were, present company accepted, prone to living in smug little self-reinforcing enclaves. And we can't do that anymore because people laugh at us and we hear it. So we can't do that anymore, that's good. We're more connected to audiences, that's also good in my mind, because if there's a relationship between me and you, you might support what I do. And I think that's important. So I'll live with a lot of downside of engagement, audience engagement, and we get a lot, and I hate to say, sorry everybody, particularly women, we do get a lot of really gratuitous feedback. Not all of it about our work. In fact, some of it nothing to do with our work. And that is a really tough environment to be in as a practitioner. Sometimes you really don't need to hear from someone that you look like a pig on television. Sometimes you really don't need that. So it's tough. I think it is necessary. I'll continue to stride out in that environment and try and make connections with people. I find trolling mystifying. Do you guys get trolling? Like, do you understand it? It's sort of, I find it so odd. And a good friend of mine said to me, you're confused because you're a person who likes to make connections with people. You like to get out and have a conversation with people. You don't get that the person at the other end of the conversation doesn't want a conversation with you. They just want to throw a rock at you. And so I did waste a fair bit of time, I think, in the opening, trying to have conversations with people who just want to chuck rocks at you. And so I don't do that now, but I still think there's more upside to downside.
What do we know about the audience that follows, say, a blog through the day? Who are these people? And indeed, how do they have time to do that?
Well, it's bizarre, totally bizarre. But what I can tell you is that there is a very large audience. Huge. We took this project out as a daily proposition at Fairfax, and I have to confess to you, the bosses weren't that into it. They really didn't like it that much, and they kind of buried it. And we had lots of arguments to lift the prominence of it. But bizarrely, the audience found us, and the audience lifted it, incredibly. And since I went to Guardian Australia, I was hired to do the live blog because I was sort of one of the few people doing it as a daily proposition in Australia at that time. It's been widely copied now. Went to Guardian Australia, bam, audience still there, massive. Every day we do Politics Live. My lovely colleague Amy Romikis has taken the helm of that in more recent times. Every day we do it, it's top three of what we do in terms of traffic. Now, Michelle says, who's the audience? Obviously, lots of insiders, in inverted commas, people in the building, staffers, people obsessed with politics, public servants, all kinds of people. But you also, it's funny, you wander around a major city and someone bows you up to have a conversation, just ordinary people all over the shop have seen the blog, read the blog, had some interaction with the blog, hate the blog, love the blog, whatever, you'll hear all about it. So it's a large and mixed audience, and it's like the audience for all live coverage is massive. That's why we do it, because people want it. People, live coverage on The Guardian is always the biggest thing we do, always. So it's not like we're following you in terms of what we're giving you. So you keep reading it, we keep doing it.
Can I take you back to this point of connection? And obviously these internet sites these days, have connection with audiences of a sort. But if you go back to newspapers 30, 40, whatever years ago, communities felt they owned those newspapers in a very personal way. The Sydney Morning Herald, many people in Sydney felt a very strong identification with that paper. Same with The Age in Melbourne and no doubt other city-based papers. Do you think that sort of connection operates in the new digital site world, or is it some other sort, a more utilitarian sort perhaps?
I think it's the same impulse. Certainly working at The Guardian, our audience is so passionate. Man. The latest Reuters digital media survey, which I have some involvement with the University of Canberra, indicated that our audience is the most media literate audience in the country.
Not surprised.
No. So I think because, I have a very... We're old age characters, Michelle and I. I think the Guardian audience is very similar to the age audience and identifies with the Guardian in the same passionate proprietorial terms as the age audience. But it is different. The relationship you have with an audience as a digital publication is different to a newspaper. It's a good question. That's a really good question.
Now, as time's moving on, I want to talk a bit, or get you to talk a bit, about the coverage of Donald Trump, because this is always something that seems to send journalists into a funk of one sort or another. Mm-hmm. Why do you think people journalists are so find it so difficult to come to grips with how you cover what has been a sort of political outsider style? It's not as though we're responsible for the style, unless you feel that the media is responsible for getting him there. Why not cover it just as you would cover a more conventional politician? Why this feeling of agitation about how we, or how the American journalists covered Trump?
Because conventional methods don't work.
Why not?
Because I think there was a lot of anger about the American media when Trump was elected. And a lot of people blamed the American media, which I found a bit hard because a lot of the journalism I consumed during that period was impeccable. It was really fantastic. But what we didn't really see in Australia was the impact of the cable channels and the constant elevation. It's like it's where this conversation started about perfect storms and catch-22s. Trump is the living case study of this. He doesn't care about facts. He doesn't inhabit a world that operates in a fact-based realm. A lot of his supporters don't care about facts. They do not care about facts. And for journalists, that's our lifeblood. That's what we do. So it's like a clash of civilizations, literally. And I think certainly, cable, the American media played a part. Absolutely. There's a little chapter in the book where I have this nightmare with myself about did we create Donald Trump? Because we did. We kind of did. So you've got to examine that and think that through. I mean, we didn't entirely create him. There's a lot of other underlying factors, but part of our disruption helps him. It helps a Trump-like character because the normal rules of engagement don't apply. That's why journalists are so existential about it, because it's like looking at... it's like you've dedicated your whole life to a certain set of values and propositions, and then you are confronted with the fact that it doesn't mean anything. It's a pretty tough thing to try and come to terms with. So that's why the existential...
But shouldn't the journalist be bringing the same critical approach to reporting to the politician wherever the politician stands, either on the spectrum or in style?
Absolutely. It's all we can do. At the end of the day, it's all we can do. I don't think we should treat Trump any differently to anybody else, except obviously he is a person that requires constant vigilance because of the inclinations of the individual. But it's tough. It's really tough. And that sort of self-aware journalism that I'm trying to talk about, understand that you're working in a disrupted environment, understand that the tools of your environment can be turned against your mission. Understand that, have that acuity about it. Understand that's your new reality is really important, and try and communicate that to readers, I think is actually very important. So it's, yes, of course we should just deal with Trump like any other political
leader. But do you think that Trump, in fact, sort of used as a tool of his campaigning, freaking out the media? Because in many cases, dealing with politicians is something of a contest between media and the political people. Did Trump in fact act cleverly and unnerve people, put them off their normal job, their normal game, if you like?
Well, I didn't see a lot of evidence of that, not in the media I consumed. I thought people really doubled down and did the job, actually, like really doubled down and did the job. Lots of really good deep reporting about what was happening at a societal level in America, who Trump's supporters
were. So there should have been less angst.
Well, Cobber, not everyone has your equanimity.
Right.
Some of us lose it sometimes.
Let's just move on to the question of brands. Years and years and years ago, even before our time or my time, there were few bylines in papers, and mostly the journalists operated in a fairly anonymous way, not entirely, but for most people. Now it's not only full of bylines, but there are many brand journalists. Do you think that that's a good development or a bad development?
I'm very binary tonight, Cobber, aren't you? Is it a good development? It certainly changed things. It has changed things. We print types were sort of... We loved our rumpled anonymity, really, of the old era, where we could just wander around in plain sight and no one knew who you were. That was kind of fantastic. And that's changed now because we're all of us, you know, on the television jibber-jabbering all the time. So that's certainly changed. Is it good or bad? It's sort of, it's bad in the sense of losing that lightness of foot that you can move around. It's good though, it's back to those connection points with readers, and if people form a relationship with you and your work, I do think that's important. And being transparent and open and accessible is important. And so that's kind of the flip side of the brand, I guess. It's like people know who you are, know what you do, know broadly what you're about, feel like they can come up and have a yak with you about whatever. I think that's actually quite good. But it has changed the nature of things, particularly for print, because it used to be that only the electronic types had profiles. It wasn't really us, except for doyens like yourself, obviously.
Okay, so let's stop there and open it up to your questions and your comments. If people could keep questions as brief as possible, then we can get in the most. There's one up here in the middle. First spotted.
Very briefly, could you comment? I'm very interested in how you can... You talked about the Guardian and the Age as the literate audience. But how do you get this sort of more fact-based, better analysis to a broader community so we have a better informed electorate? Or is it just inevitable that many people just don't have time to consume serious news, and they, or is it possible to get a more, you know, good journalism down out to a whole lot of people?
I think, well, in terms of The Guardian, because we're a sort of relatively new player in Australia, people think we're a bit niche, but we're not. On the latest Nielsen figures, we're fifth by in terms of readership. So we're bigger than perhaps you think in terms of reach, but we don't have a print edition in this country, so people who don't read newspapers obviously don't read us. How we get our stuff to people, well, again, one of the features of the digital disruption is that people are not really getting their news now via masthead, if that makes sense. Most people are actually getting their news in their social media feed. And some people understand that that journalism is produced by a media organisation, like The Guardian or like Fairfax or like News or whatever. They understand, you know, more literate people get that. But when news just slaps into your news feed, you don't really know. It's sort of that fake news proposition too that I was sort of touching on before, right? There's all this information washing through channels of uncertain authorship, basically. So how do we get it? Well, readership, I know, you know, print circulation has been in decline, and we're sort of, although the tail of print's been longer than I thought it would be, it is in decline, but readership has never been higher. Never at any point in our history. So loads of people are reading. What they're reading, where they're getting it from, these are all big questions, but loads of people are reading. Loads.
Who's next?
Hello.
Thanks to both of you for all your contributions and for being here tonight as well. I hope I'm being heard. As a news junkie, I'm sort of overwhelmed. I've recently sort of broken down the barriers and gone online, and, you know, there's just constant news info coming through at me all day. And being retired, I do have enough time, you know, to sort of explore a little bit. And I'm also a devotee of Insiders, and thank you, Catherine. You know, it's always a great hour's viewing, you know, when you're a member of the panel.
Thank you.
But I'm just wondering about the financial drivers, you know, behind these scenarios, and if you could just explicate a little bit to somebody and naive about all that, how you survive financially.
Yeah. With our fingers crossed. No, how we survive financially, you mean The Guardian specifically or more generally? Across the board. Okay, well, obviously the ABC is funded by the taxpayer, so there's a big commercial, public broadcasting in Australia, SBS and the ABC, so that obviously is funded by the taxpayer. The rest of us, well, we're just working out different models at the moment for how we sustain ourselves. What happened when the internet arrived is all those lovely classified ads that used to basically pay for newspapers dried up, migrated online, went to the big behemoths, Google, Facebook, the big players, right? So that's been the big hit to our business models for those of us who are not publicly funded. So we've had to work out what you do when you don't have that revenue. Now, various people have tried different things. If you're online now, if you're getting your news online, you'll know that some organisations have a paywall, right? You can't access the content unless you pay. That's one model. At The Guardian, we have another model. Philosophically, we want to keep the journalism as open as possible for as long as possible. Philosophically, we have been opposed to paywalls. I think we will only implement one if we're about to go under. So maybe worry if you see a paywall. Anyway, jokes. No, what we're doing is something called membership. And this is what I mean about relationships with readers and why they matter in the digital age. What we've been asking readers to do, and I know the Conversation's had a funding drive recently, which is a bit similar, is we ask readers to make a contribution. They don't get any special content for that. They get, I think, probably a nice note maybe from me sometimes or from Lenore Taylor sometimes or a nice first dog on the moon cartoon or something, you know, thanks for helping us. But you pay your annual fee or whatever you want to pay, and that basically becomes a revenue stream for us. I think the Guardian in the UK, I think membership is now a bigger revenue stream for Guardian in the UK than commercial advertising is. And I think we're pretty close in Australia to building up that level of membership. Our membership drive in Australia has been enormously successful, thank God. And we're very grateful, obviously, for the support of our audience, because you get what you pay for. That's it. So we're doing membership. In Europe, there's some interesting crowdfunding things happening, and we've actually done that at The Guardian in Australia for a project called Wide Brown Earth, where basically we took that project to market. We said, we think there's a bunch of stories in environmental regulation that are not getting reported just because we don't have time and resources. Do you agree with us? If you do, give us a donation and let's see what happened. We went into that exercise, I think, thinking, oh, gee, maybe we'll get 20 grand. That'd be great. We got 150 in 2 days. So those models, I think we'll see more of in Australia, those crowdfunding models. They're starting in Europe. There are journalism organisations in Europe who basically just take their journalism to the market and say, what do you reckon about X? There's some downside risks associated with those, with that trend as well, which we haven't got time to get into tonight, but are nonetheless there. But we're experimenting with asking our audiences to support what we do. That's how we're surviving, basically.
When you're on Insiders, do you mm-hmm. do that just in the public interest? Because I wonder whether the ABC paid you.
Oh, no. No, the ABC, for Insiders, the ABC covers our travel costs, obviously, and puts, because it's filmed in Melbourne, it's not filmed here, so we have to go to Melbourne, and we have to go overnight because the fog in Canberra, we may not get there. And we get an appearance fee. It's not huge, but we get an appearance fee for doing that. But I don't do it for the money. Insiders is a great show. People love it. The most extraordinary number of people watch it. I'm kind of amazed by how many people watch it. Like, all the time. Amazed. But anyway, there it is. So they kind of cover our costs and give us a, thanks for coming payment. So that's how that works.
Down here.
Hello, thank you, Catherine. It's very interesting listening to you. I just wondered what your views were when you talk about disruption and sort of the point the gentleman earlier made about an informed electorate.
Yep.
How you balance in the media Kim Kardashian-type journalism, so the David Leyenhelm thing, versus investigative journalism like what Four Corners and Adele Ferguson and Kate McClymont do that lead to things being uncovered, people being prosecuted, policy being improved, and those sorts of things. How you balance sort of the clickbait versus the things that will bring real change and real information and benefit to people.
Yeah, well, different organisations have different models for how they balance that. BuzzFeed, for example, I don't know if any of you guys are BuzzFeed consumers, but they have a massive, massive clickbait machine model which funds a small but influential, in terms of around the world and increasingly in Australia, either significant news breaks or investigations. So that's how they do it. They try and walk both sides of the street. When I say about paying for journalism, I mean this very specifically. Investigations cost money. They take time. And the news organisations that can do investigative work with big societal impact, like change things, expose corruption, bring people to account, the news organisations that do that journalism, a very critical part of being able to do that journalism is something perhaps people have never thought about, and that is having the resources to defend a defamation action. which are enormously expensive in this country. I cannot tell you how expensive those trials are. And so anyone doing journalism with serious impact of the sort that Kate McClymont does, or people of her ilk, or Adele, or you've got to work for an organisation that can afford to defend a defamation action, because it'll be brought. It'll be brought. So it's just a point about, please pay for journalism if you support it. In terms of, again, the balancing, well, you know, the big mastheads in Australia, Fairfax News, they're still doing investigations, and, you know, of good quality. At The Guardian, we don't have massive resources to do investigations, but I think some of our reporting, for example, about what's happening on Nauru and Manus has been in that ilk, in terms of exposing what's going on, and that reporting is really hard to do, and there's a lot of barriers put in your path to doing it. So we will do as much of it as our resources allow, which brings back to the fundamental point. You want the journalism done, support organisations, and allow them to function at a commercial level where they can afford to defend their work.
These days, the big organisations tend to combine more than they used to for these sorts of projects. For example, the ABC and Fairfax quite often do joint investigations. I presume partly that is to reduce the individual costs, although it would also be to increase exposure.
Hi. I listen to both of you in podcast format a lot. And I consider this to be part of the whole disruption picture.
Yep.
And I'm interested in your thoughts on the introduction of these new formats for journalism. There's a part of me that considers the conversations that I hear via podcast, it's kind of like a special sort of journalism. It's not journalism in the traditional sense. And through those conversations that you have with your interviewees, we get a very different flavour. It's much more personal. We get a sense of where you come from as a journalist, and we definitely get a different flavour of the interviewee in a personal sense. And I think that's a really interesting shift, and I just wondered what your take is on that kind of exposure and that different kind of conversation in a journalistic context, because I find it quite enriching to get, you know, one and the other.
Oh, I love the pod. You like your pod. I mean, we're stressed out because it's another thing that we do, and if we don't have a guest, we do get a bit stressed out. But I've got some thoughts about it. Why don't you bowl up on thought?
Well, podcast in one way easier than some other journalism. In other ways, they're not. My podcast producer is Eliza Berlage is here tonight, and she will attest that sometimes they're quite trying to do. But I agree with you that they are a different form from what we do much of the time. That, of course, depends on the sort of way you pitch the podcast. In our case, what we try and do is really a fairly straight, long-form interview. It's different from the sort of interview you'll see on Sky, for example. We don't go in for the gotcha stuff as much as some commercial interviewers would do. But it's really trying to get the person's view across in a context where they get adequate opportunity to explain themselves and what they're saying and standing for, but a not uncritical sort of interview. So the stress is very much on them and giving them that sort of exposition opportunity.
Mm. Yeah, my pod's the thing I love doing the most. It's my favourite thing. I love it. It's sort of... it's a different way of communicating, which I'm always looking to do. I'm always looking for a different way to communicate with an audience. And in that format, I'm a bit like Michelle, and our podcasts are fairly similar, really. They're long-form interviews. And we don't interview like broadcast journos because we're not. They're quite different skills. You know, if you translate yourself to a television environment or a radio environment, particularly a breaking news radio environment, You just push for the news line. That's what you do. And those, the conversations that we try and have on our pods are more about long-form conversation as a thing in itself and a means of connecting to an audience in a different way and deliberately not in broadcast style because we're not broadcast journos. We interview like print journos. What you're hearing, why it sounds a bit new, is that you're hearing print journos, how they interview, live, recorded, whereas we just used to do that and, of course, it wasn't recorded anywhere. So we have a different style and it's got a different methodology and a different approach. But, yeah, I love it. It's great.
There's one right up back here.
There's one here. Hi. I must say I'm a huge fan of the podcast too. It blows my mind that we get all that entertainment for free. I think you could probably get away with charging a subscription for that. I was going to say you have a lot more content to produce, a lot fewer people to do it with. How do you end up with the time to roll those ideas around in your mind now? Is there less of that happening?
Sorry.
Well, maybe not you personally, but, you know. But how do people find the time to mull over ideas and to develop a story when there's the impetus is to deliver straight away?
What a great question. I'm aiming for the 25th hour in the day. That's you know, when someone gives me that, that'll be great. Well, the unvarnished answer is, sometimes what you do suffers as a consequence of quantity. Like, you know, I often write 5 news stories a day. I don't think they're going to win me a Pulitzer. When do I get time to think? You make time. You just make time to think. And the sort of, I think the toughest thing, I'll be interested in Michelle's thoughts on that actually. I think the toughest thing in the modern or in the contemporary environment is just saying, no, damn it, I am going to think. I am going to think. I'm going to pull off. I'm not going to do that fourth story. I'm going to pull off. That's hard. And also having the courage of your own way of communicating is also hard because there's a lot of, you know, the medium kind of homogenises it. So you've got to, have the courage of your own voice and your own way of wanting to communicate with readers. And that's hard. I mean, all of this decision-making, it's sort of like you're making so many more decisions so much more quickly. It does, like, some days you feel like your brain's going to explode, truly. It's not fun. But you make the time. You make the time. What say you?
Well, I do think this is a problem. It is very hard to get enough time to consider issues, especially hard issues, because if you're a general political correspondent, as we are, you're moving from issue to issue through a week. For example, this week we've talked about the Lionhelm story, which in a way is a simple enough thing, but there was the ABC story, and then over the last 24 hours, this complete shocker of a GST story. And even, frankly, if we'd had a lot more time, I'd have had a lot more time to think, I couldn't come out with any really sensible assessment that would stand up to critical analysis of what all that means. So, especially in our operation, which is only one person writing out of Canberra, that is a very difficult situation because you don't have any time to talk around to enough people to understand a specialist area. And also there is this phenomenon that we now have of things being dropped. So, for example, the GST story is dropped on an embargoed basis, but one of the conditions is that you don't get other... You don't pass it on, you don't get expert opinion until you've written the story and then the commentary and reaction comes the next day. Now, you can imagine with a very complicated story, that means that you are, in a sense, a prisoner of the issuer of that story. And we were talking a bit about before about
being captured, as it were, by the system and the speed of it all and so on, but you can also be captured by a minister who puts out a story, a complicated story, on those sorts of conditions. So that's just one aspect of not getting enough opportunity and time to think, but there are many others too, and you don't get enough time, even when you are able to talk to people, to get around as many people as you should as a generalist reporter. Mm.
True that.
Hi.
On that note...
Oh. I think you've got one.
I am now the most unpopular person.
Oh dear, bring the hammer down.
It is almost 7 o'clock, and we did promise that we would finish by 7 o'clock. I know there are more questions, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to draw this to a close. And what a conversation it's been. And I think what I didn't expect from this conversation was just how considered the balancing act is that journalists perform, both as journalists, as professionals, and we forget that, you know, people train to be these things. You're not a journalist just because you're a citizen with an opinion and a mobile phone. You know, there is something here that is valuable and precious, but the balancing act between being a brand but also being an acknowledged expert, the balance between engaging in things that you know are going to make you some money so that you can do the other stuff that's important, recognizing the fact that some of your audience will be easily distracted, but at the same time knowing that there will be hopefully a loyal membership. Membership was a word that came up a number of times, to continue the project, which is about the civic impact of journalism. I love the fact that, Michelle, you appear to approach digital disruption with a kind of equanimity, and Catherine used the word, that had me thinking, well, yeah, maybe all this too will all pass. Maybe this is just a moment where we are like rabbits in the headlights, but at some point we'll figure out the way, and we will be back to where Catherine can be as optimistic as she once was about the power and the potential of the internet and of digital, because we will have figured out that as citizens, and this I think was the heart of this for me, that we are not just consumers of this information. You know, part of what drives journalism now is us and our apparent appetite for the inconceivable and the irreparable and the generally abhorrent. But we need to exercise some more self-restraint, and we need to recognize that being a citizen means actually taking some responsibility for what journalism can do, but also what we would like it to do. And how do we make sure that we protect this time for those people who are experts to think, so that they can grapple with the really important questions? That is the most frightening thing of all for me, that we are prepared to live in a world where none of us can find the time to do the thinking that's necessary to repair the damage that we are sometimes inflicting on ourselves. So much here to talk about. For those of you who haven't bought the book, still time to do that, but for now, please join me in thanking Catherine.
Thank you so very much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the series via your favourite podcast app. Subscribe and by all means tell all of your friends. Thank you so much to Hannah Izard, who did production on this episode this week. Bless you, Hannah, and we will see you all again very soon.